This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
The New Zealand Young Writers Festival welcomes young writers aged 15 to 35 of all kinds to celebrate a diverse range of wordsmithing, including slam poetry, playwriting, songwriting, short fiction, novels, zines, screenwriting, poetry, journalism, blogging, critical content creation, podcasts, review writing, and more. It's Aotearoa's only literary festival focused solely on young writers, and it's held right here in Otipoti, Dunedin. This live recorded podcast series from the 2025 New Zealand Young Writers Fest is brought to you by Otago Access Radio and supported by Dunedin UNESCO City of Literature. Join us in celebrating Aotearoa's next generation of literary talent.
Publishing in Aotearoa Today, an insider's guide. For many unpublished writers, getting a foot in the door of the publishing world can feel like an impossible task, often shrouded in mystery and seemingly impervious borders. We're here to tell you it's not. Three seasoned writers, editors, and literary practitioners get together to korero about the world of publishing in Aotearoa today. What to do, what not to do, and the myriad of ways in which to make it happen. Join writer and starling editor Louise Wallace, chatbook micropress publisher Josiah Morgan, and children's writer and publisher Kitty Brown in conversation with Lindley Edmatis, writer and current Landfall editor, as they discuss the various avenues that allowed them to make their entry into the world of publishing in Aotearoa. Presented in association with University of Otago, Otako Whakaihuaka.
Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. My name is Kate Schrader. I'm one of the co-directors of Dunedin Fringe Arts Trust that puts on the New Zealand Young Writers Festival. Welcome. Oh, thank you so much. Stop. My ego is big enough already. Welcome to Publishing in Aotearoa Today, an insider's guide. Now, before I welcome our MC and they welcome our panelists, I'd just like to take a moment to thank the sponsor for today's event, the University of Otago Division of Humanities. Yes, woo! Big ups to the arts. Thank you for getting behind the vision of a festival that celebrates the next generation of literary talent in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Now, they have loaned us a very incredible and absolutely incredible MC for today's event, Lindley Edmeads. Yes, that's right. Lindley is an author, a poet, and a scholar. She is the author of three books, As the Verb Tenses, Listening In, and Bordering on Miraculous, a collaboration with painter Saskia Leek, and actually also, hot scoop, her current book, Project, Hiding Places, an ortho-theoretical exploration on the institution of motherhood, wow, is going to be published in September 2025. And for the smart people in the room, that is, in fact, this month.
Thursday.
This Thursday?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, big round of applause.
You're all welcome.
She's the current editor of Landfall Tauraka Aotearoa Arts and Letters and Lectures in English and Creative Writing at the University of Otago. Holy guacamole. Please welcome your MC for this afternoon, Lindley Edmeads.
Wow, what a welcoming crowd. Thank you so much for this introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here, to be sitting in this chair and to have these folk with us. So just a bit of kind of how this is going to run. We're going to basically just have a korero. I've got some kind of open questions I want to ask. And then we're going to make some space for you guys to ask questions as well. So thank you to the Young Writers Festival. This is such a great initiative. I was saying to Eloise, we've been in this game for a while and we didn't have a Young Writers Festival back in the day. So we're the old festival goers now, which feels a little bit uncomfortable, but I still feel like a young writer at heart. So it's such an amazing thing that we've got in our city in Otipoti, and great that you're all here. So thank you to the organisers. I will introduce my esteemed guests. So to my immediate right is Josiah Morgan. Josiah Morgan probably doesn't need much introduction because he's been involved in things over the weekend. But Josiah's come from Ototahi. He's a poet and interdisciplinary artist. I always struggle with that word, interdisciplinary artist. Currently working as a disability support worker and facilitator. Author of several collections, the most recent of which is called I'm Still Growing, which came out with Dead Bird Books last year, I think. Yep. Also an actor, also a writer of plays, also an editor of things, and does some work as on the editorial board for Ngā Puka Puka Pika Pika. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So welcome, Josiah. I feel like there's going to be a lot of clapping. That's great. next along there is Louise Wallace. Louise Wallace also doesn't need much introduction. She is the author of 4 books of poetry and most recently a novel called Ash, which is a beautiful book. If you haven't read it, go and read it today, tonight. she is also the founder of Starling, which many of you have started. a great supporter of young writers in New Zealand. But also Ash has just been, it was published by Te Ringa Waka, as you might know, but it's just been picked up in Australia, the UK and the US. So yeah, go Louise. and on top of all that, Louise has just submitted her PhD. So Louise has got lots of secrets to tell us, so we'll try and get them out of her. And last but not least is Kitty Brown. Kitty is from Dunedin, Otipoti, Otako, I believe. And Kitty is the author of more than 11 bilingual books for children. most of which I've got on my shelf at home, actually. Very, very good. The Te Reo Pepe series, and more recently a book about Matariki. But also, importantly, the festival co-director for Dunedin Writers and Readers Festival, which and the director of Kaupapa Māori for that festival, just launched the festival program last week, and congratulations, it looks really amazing. So, wow, what an array of talent here. I'm going to start by asking some kind of questions that might help like demystify the process a little bit. So it was called An Insider's Guide to Writing in New Zealand. So we're just going to try and nut that out a little bit and get some inside scoop, if you like. So I thought by asking, first of all, if you could tell us about your kind of individual journey towards publication and that moment when you kind of felt like you might have arrived as a writer, Josiah.
I have a very strange journey to publication. I spent a lot of my teenage years reading a lot of small press American work, and I found the publication process quite mystified, actually, in relation to what you were saying. I had no real sense of how to access it or where to move from, but I was reading this small press American work, and one day I just looked at some of the writing that I had, and I was like, I feel like this is kind of good. and I sent it off to 3 of the small presses that I was reading, and one of them very luckily got back to me and accepted a first chapbook for publication. And that was very strange because the pathway there ultimately is that I was reading really widely and I was writing stuff that was deeply related to the publishers that I sent it to. It wasn't stuff that was kind of generated in my own practice in a little bubble. It wasn't stuff that was generated in relation to what I thought someone would want to read, but it was that I was reading a very concentrated set of materials. And then I published a few more books with small presses in the States. I tried to kind of crack into the Aotearoa scene over that time, and I would frequently find myself at open mics reading work that people in New Zealand were like, what the hell is this? and so I kind of stepped back for a little bit. And then I started to get invited to Word Christchurch, which sort of started to open up an understanding of what was going on in this country and the types of poetic personas and the types of voice that exist here. And that's not to say that any voice is better than another, but that the publishing landscape here is very different than the publishing landscape in America, for good reasons. And that was relevant. And the first publication that I had in New Zealand was with Out Here, which was Chris Teese and Emma Barnes, and they had selected a couple of poems from that first book that had come out in America. But it took another few years before I started to regularly publish here, and that was often in response to writers that I started to understand were doing something that I was sort of aligned with. I guess Liz Breslin, who has been around a bit, was a real inspiration really early, and then seeing Laura Borrowdale's short story collection with Dead Bird Books, Sex with Animals, come out, and the big kind of controversy around that due to her role as a teacher, I looked at that and I was like, oh, maybe there is a window for my weird, hypersexual, like slightly uncomfortable work. And just coincidentally, Liz and Laura had come out on Dead Bird Books. I submitted a manuscript to Dead Bird as early as 2019, got no reply. Eventually in 2022, I was in the same room with Dominic and he saw me read and he was like, we'd like to do a book. And so it's right time, right place. Mm. And also, reading stuff that was in alignment and knowing that they were the people to talk to.
Yeah.
Mm. So it's quite a long answer, but it was a very strange journey. Mm. Far away. I hadn't been to the States at the time. It was all email.
Mm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Before we move on, I just want to ask, I guess, what the attraction was to those early small press American books that you were reading. And, yeah, how did you come across that? Because we don't hear that story very often for young poets.
Yeah, a lot of it was probably related to queerness. Mm-hmm. I was a really strange teenager. I spent like year 11 reading Ulysses and stuff like that, which is really obnoxious, but it just is what I like. Like, it's still what I like. And as a result of that, I ended up discovering this writer named Dennis Cooper, who is he's from the kind of New York scene, late 80s, early 90s, as a kind of outgrowth of Kathy Acker and Dodi Bellamy and a few other kind of stalwarts of the very radical queer scene. And through Dennis Cooper's blog, he would recommend these small press books. Mm. And he would also, he's kind of amazing. He's very well known, certainly overseas, but he replies to everyone that communicates with him on his blog. And so building that interpersonal relationship, the things that, you know, a festival environment give us the chance to do, building that relationship with him on his blog was quite literally life-changing. There's no way I would be published without having had weird internet interactions with a writer that really ultimately actually gave me a voice. Like, it was ultimately that I read his work and I was like, whoa, here's someone saying something that is about my experience. And I certainly had that experience when I was reading at open mics and people were like, what the hell is this? I hadn't learned how to mediate the persona in a way that was digestible for an audience. If so, for some of you that have read some of my stuff, you'll be like, I know what he means. Yeah, but I've kind of learned that now. But it took a while.
Yeah. Fascinating. Lots more questions, but we'll circle back around. Louise, how about you? Yours is a kind of slightly different journey in that very much grounded in New Zealand and now overseas.
Yeah, I really enjoy I love this session because I think there are so many different ways to get into writing, and you're about to see a different way from Josiah's. But this is awesome because, like, when I was this age, like, we didn't have things like this. And also even now, like, nobody really talks about this stuff. So I felt very unsure of what to do in this position. So I probably followed a more traditional publishing route, and also, like you say, very grounded in New Zealand. So, I mean, for a start, I actually hated poetry at high school because a lot of the stuff I was being shown as like a 15 to 16 year old girl was like very old and dead men, and I just really didn't know how to relate to that. So once I got to university and started, I was studying just English. I mean, like, not creative writing specifically, but just like being exposed to like a range of contemporary poetry really opened my eyes as to like what it could be. So I really got into it then, and then I started doing a couple of undergrad creative writing workshops, which are available in most New Zealand cities now at universities. I know that, you know, sometimes workshops and institutions, you know, get a bad rap for, you know, it's essentially like just churning out writers and things. But I have found workshops really valuable in terms of giving me skills on how to give feedback, receive feedback, improve my own work, which you're all doing as part of this festival. but also community, which is one of the like biggest joys of my writing life, and also like the most amazing like things you can receive as part of it. And my great example is when I did an undergraduate creative writing course, I was 19, and one of the people on that course that I, as one of my very dear friends, is Chris Teese, poet laureate, or former poet laureate, and that's where we met. And so, I mean, you know, that kind of relationship and that you can work with that person over time is just one of the best things you can get from doing a course like that. And, yeah, so started sending work out to individual journals, mostly New Zealand-based. Yeah, and I can speak to that a bit later if we get into how to approach that and things. But yeah, it was a lot of rejection, as people often say, which is true. But yeah, eventually like some successes that would accumulate. And then I did a master's in creative writing at Victoria, so the 1 year course. So also can speak to that if people are interested in that. And then, yeah, approached a publisher with a full collection. But like you say, I really liked what Josiah said about timing, and I'm especially learning that with this kind of international publication. And it was very true for my first book as well, as I had sent it to Heading Awaki University Press in Wellington and hadn't heard anything. And then I ran into the publisher. I left work sick and had my hoodie up and was walking home and feeling terrible. And I walked past the publisher and I was like, oh, God, and hoping he didn't see me. I think he might have, because then he must have remembered that I had sent him a manuscript and replied that day. But I often think, you know, like if I hadn't run into him, like would that have happened? So, yeah, lots to do with timing and just, you know, but being persistent, because it may just be that kind of one lucky chance and things like that, yeah.
Thanks, Louise. How about you, Kitty? I think it's a different story altogether for you.
Yeah, I think it is a unique story. I grew up near a library, like 100 metres down the road from my house, and so I had this love of books that was also instilled by my parents, but and this real trust in books, and then lived that life and always read widely. And when I became a mother, I trusted that the information that I needed to learn Te Reo Māori and to teach Te Reo Māori to my baby would be there in a book, and that I would find it in a library, on a shelf or in a bookshop. And when I went to look for these books, they weren't there, and I could see the books that I wanted, and I wanted them to be really good quality books, and I wanted them to be board books because I had babies, and I wanted them to have beautiful illustrations and be really high quality and high production value, and they just weren't there, and the only Te Reo Māori books that I could find were like kind of like school journal style things and stapled together, and like people, I don't want to like diminish the mahi of anyone who has put work into creating Te Reo Māori books for kids ever. But at that time, that was 2015 or 2012, and it was just the beginning, and it's only been, you know, 10 years or 12 years or something. There's been this flourishing of Te Reo Māori publishing. So it's sort of at the start of that, and I decided to that because those books weren't there, how I wanted them, so I went down a rabbit hole trying to figure out how much a publisher would pay me to create these books. And I realised that there was this kind of perfect storm of they weren't going to pay me enough and they weren't going to do them how I wanted them to look and how I wanted them to be. And so I decided to self-publish them. and got my cousin on board, and we formed LPP, which we always intended to be a publishing house. And yeah, we did it ourselves, and then it was super, super hard work for about 5 years, but we had great success, and then we got picked up by a publisher. So I sort of have done both things, yeah.
So the books were out already, Te Reo Pepe series, that you'd produced. I mean, you'd obviously got someone to print them for you, but then a publisher came on board. Who was the publisher?
Alan and Unwin.
Right,
yeah.
So quite a major.
And that happened because we both were going in different directions. My cousin and I were both kind of doing different projects and starting new work, and, you know, we'd done this as a kind of late-night hobby, that turned into
babies.
A full-time, you know, job. And so we wanted to do other things, and we thought we can't let Reo Pepe just disappear. We wanted to make sure that our books remained on the shelves, and so we approached publishers at that point. Yeah. Mm.
Wow, so yeah, a real array of stories. There's no, what's that saying, there's many ways to skin a cat, I think. and you will all have your own journeys toward this. I think there are probably people in the room that have got another story. I want to just kind of segue there, just because you mentioned, Kitty, the self-publishing, and then the idea of small presses, and then going through a mainstream press like Victoria or Te Ringa Waka. Just a bit of reflection on, if you were going to self-publish for some of these people, how might you go and do that? Or what are the pitfalls and benefits of going with a publisher?
I think now there's even, like, back in 2012, there weren't the ways and means of self-publishing that there are now. That's also really evolved in the last 10, 12 years because of the ability to have these kind of international online relationships, and the services are there a lot more now. It was a lot of hard work figuring it out, and there's a lot of pitfalls in terms of it's not really set up to go around the author to make the money. It's set up for the printers to make the money, and the, you know, like everyone else. that was tricky.
Even things like distribution, right? Like you would have had to send them all out to bookshops.
Yeah, we did that all ourselves for 1 year, and then we realised that it was just too much work for us, and so we got a deal with Nationwide Distributors. And so you can do that. You can get a distributor. You know, you do the mahi around the printing and all that, and then a distributor will make your life so much easier. But it is, for us, it was really important to have relationships with bookshops across the country. And so we built those ourselves. And then when Nationwide came on board, they also had great networks and relationships with bookshops. So it just kind of grew in strength after that.
So lots of hard work, eh? In that first year.
It was, but we were really passionate about it. And we believed that our books were really beautiful. So it wasn't hard in that sense, because we felt passionate about it.
And I can totally testify, beautiful books. Thanks. Great, great things to have on the shelf. What about you, Louise? Did you ever consider self-publishing at the beginning?
I didn't, but I did just want to pick up on points from both Josiah and Kitty, and I think this is more relevant to Starling, but I think it's really important that act of, if you see a gap, like you don't need permission to fill it. You can fill it now. And it doesn't have to be as massive as producing a beautiful series of publication. I mean, I imagine that seems quite daunting. If you want to make a zine that's filling a particular space that you don't feel is addressed right now, there is nothing better than that you can do, because then you're kind of making the publishing space what you want it to be. And Josiah's done that with Ngā Pika Pika as well. So I really encourage people to not see New Zealand publishing as something that's fixed, and the publishers say, my publisher, you know, yes, there is that element of like you need to be accepted to be published with them, but there are other ways of doing that, and so it can be a more fluid thing than everything just being in place and feeling locked out of that. But in terms of my own writing, I mean, I just wouldn't have had the capacity to attempt what Kitty has done at that age for me. And I think I also needed, I think if you are publishing with a publisher, there is an amount of like a confidence boost from that. Mm-hmm. Like someone else is saying, I believe in your work. So that can be quite powerful. It's just a matter of getting to that point, I guess, is the challenge. Mm-hmm.
Having someone invest in you in a way.
Yeah. And that's about the work that you're doing, like making that the best it can be, so that they see those qualities in your work. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then for you, Josiah, the small press was obviously attractive, and seeing something again, like you say, Louise, that wasn't there. So the representation of queerness, for example,
yeah,
it wasn't apparent in New Zealand at the time.
We felt. Certainly when I started writing, it wasn't. I feel like it's more visible now. I mean, you know, I started that first US chapbook came out when I was 17 in 2018. And, yeah, certainly not in Christchurch, at least. And or at least the type of, complicated, the lineage of, like, experimental cut-up writing and actually all of that stuff. Liz was sort of the only person that I could see doing it at that time, although I know there was stuff going on around Hawea Flat as well with Annabelle Wilson and people who were living there. But it wasn't visible to me. And after doing my book launch for Dead Bird in Christchurch last February with Isla Huia and Laura, that we were just like, should we just start a chapbook press? And it was because we felt that the type of kaupapa that Dead Bird are kind of championing on a national level is still missing on a South Island kind of level. I don't know. Those of you who are from Te Waipounamu will know that sometimes we feel like it can feel a little bit like, notice us! Notice us, Creative New Zealand! Notice us, you South Island North Island publishers! It's a real problem. And so we saw that we could fill that gap. We could see that there was a lot of stuff happening in Christchurch that was really interesting. I also think part of the complexity for us is that we knew and know that as a writer or any artist advocating for yourself, you are naturally extremely exploitable because of that thing where that validation is something that is really it's hard to keep yourself going a lot of the time. And we just felt that we could offer something to enable other people to keep going. Can I share a little bit more on this?
Please, yeah.
So one of the things that I'm really hesitant about, and other people might have their own feelings, which is okay, I'm a bit hesitant about publishers that ask you to pay to be with them. And I would just caution you to be aware of that as people navigating the start of a publishing world.
I totally agree.
We were very conscious of that when starting Ngā Puka Puka Peka Peka, but the ethical considerations of making books happen is always something that's like on my mind. So this year we're publishing three Christchurch-based writers, and the books are so unbelievably good. Last year we published two Christchurch-based writers and Ruby. And Ruby's book is really, 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 really good. But also, we were in our first year, and Ruby flew herself down to Christchurch, and that relationship still sits uneasily with me in terms of what the responsibility of a publisher is and what a responsibility of a publisher should be. And it's just something that I think everyone needs to be thinking about constantly, is like, what is the onus that institutions, even when like you're the institution, it's like you and your two friends like choosing to like do something, like you're still representing like some form of ability to like make a voice. Like how are you carrying other people and being aware of that? Because artists are just extremely exploitable by nature, unfortunately.
I guess I wonder if we could talk a bit about self-promotion. You know, yeah. There's self-publishing, right? But especially if you're starting out, how much do you need to do to, you know, on social media, for example, like I've got a book coming out next week and I just cannot be asked doing any of that stuff. Like, I'm like, I've written the book, goddammit, like someone else will. But if I don't do it, you know, there's a publicist with the press, but it's a, you know, the onus is actually on me to really put myself out there. And you have to build up the energy. You have to really have that resolve in yourself. So especially for building things like community online, how do you navigate self-promotion, I guess? And do you need to be self-promoting?
Short answer, yes.
Yeah, hugely. Well, for us it was really important because we didn't have a publisher to do that mahi for us. Mm. And, you know, we were so fortunate. We started Reo Pepe in the days before Facebook had sponsored posts. there was no moderation or monitoring on Facebook at the time. And I think when we came out with our Puka Puka and we did our first, you know, da-da, on Facebook, we got like 10,000 likes.
Wow.
On our post. It was like outrageous. And then we just carried on working in that market. But now it's so hard because it is all kind of like monitored and moderated or whatever they do there to kind of not show your stuff. But, yeah, we had to do a lot of online marketing, website, particularly I think in children's book space. There's so much beautiful, bright, visual material out there. You have to really work to get seen. Yeah.
Constantly competing for space.
I think, like, I met a lady here yesterday who had a book launch at the library yesterday, and, we would do things like, you know, I'd dress up like the kuya and Kirsten would dress up like the spider and... go do these things at schools and kindies and libraries and, you know, just trying to get our puka puka out there. And we noticed that actually a huge market of ours was in kindergartens and schools. And so we kind of like directed a lot of promotion towards that niche market as well as our general marketing. Mm.
Yeah. So do you dress up, Louise, and go...
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah. I'm really thinking about, I think there is a divide between the need to promote in terms of the product, and I really struggle with the promotion of the person because I personally do not enjoy, I struggle with social media, I think. I think it is... takes a lot of energy. It's a hungry machine. The more you feed it, the more it wants to be fed. Idea that, like, if you're going to be a writer, you need, like, this huge public persona and things is really sometimes worrying to me because I do also like to believe that it's the work that is the thing we should be looking at, not, like, what products I'm trying to sell you via my Instagram or whatever. And I had some good advice recently because, I mean, this is something I still don't know the answer to and still feel discomfort with in terms of how much you have to share about yourself and things like that. I kind of sought advice from my Australian publisher because, like I say, I find it really tiring and things as well. And their advice was actually great. It was if you are going to do that stuff, you don't have to. But if you are, pick one platform and do it really well. Because I think I have been guilty of being like, oh, God, I need to be like signed up to everything and just like push the same thing, content across all, and just do a really bad job generally of like spreading myself too thin across those things. So I really liked that advice and I have quit Twitter, Blue Sky, whatever else, and I'm just, I share things on Instagram and it's actually been really good.
Liberating.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, really
great advice. What about you, Josiah? You're a big social media
Yeah, I have a harrowing social media presence. And I would love not to. I'd love to be like fully cold turkey. I'd love to be off it. It's interesting. I mean, that relationship's been very strange because that early stuff really was just the writing. The first three books were just me in my bedroom talking to no one, and people liking it. And then this kind of thing happens once it starts to become something resembling a career, where all of a sudden the product isn't the writing, the product is you. Mm-hmm. And we know that for all sorts of reasons, like book sales are down and literary festival attendance is up, and that's something complicated to think about. So what you're kind of selling is the persona version of yourself. And for anyone that's a poet, you know, the poem is not always you, or even when it is you, it's not quite you. It's some other thing. And so people get this idea, I guess, of who you are. I mean, the coincidence that led me to getting published with Dead Bird is so ridiculous, because it was a genuine persona book deal in that the event was, Dominic and I were on the same lineup. It was called Poetry Karaoke. No one was reading their own poems. Mm. I read, I can't remember what the song was, something by LMNOP. and then Dominic was like, you want to have a book with us? and so that's just like, publishing's so stupid. It's like, yeah. It's whatever. It's obviously not whatever. It's very deeply meaningful to then have the experience of sending that book and to have that pop up. But I think about it all the time, that fact that the thing that is being sold or the thing that you're marketing is some version of you that can stand up on a stage and like be like, here's a little joke, when the thing that I actually love to do is like sit in a room and like shuffle words around the page and be like, wow, these things mean seven things at the same time. How magical is that? This is literally spell casting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a lot in there. I guess I'm very, very aware of time, and I've got so many questions, and I know that you guys have got questions too. But before we came on stage and our kōrero before we met today, we actually talked about things that editors might be looking for, and I want to put to you, like, can you give us some do's and don'ts for writers starting out? Like, you know, I've got some pretty big horror stories with Landfall, which I may share. but just in general, you know, like, what are some of the things you're like, if you see that person contact you, you're like, 100% I'm not going near them, or, oh, that's interesting, I might read their work. Have you got some kind of, some par?
In our first series of NPP, we had someone submit to us their poetry collection over each poem in an individual email. and the communication sort of just continued like that over a period of months.
Oh.
So
that's a no.
That's a no. Just to be clear.
That's good insider knowledge, that is. Right there. you, Louise, have you got any horror stories?
I mean, there's the basic things like, please read submission guidelines. Every journal or outlet will have little differences, and it seems trivial, but it makes a difference when it's coming through at the other end. The editor can see you've... It reads smoothly. If it pings, if it's like, we've asked for poems to be in a single document and instead we've got five Word documents and things like that. So, yeah, it's really basic. But the other thing I think, I mean, in terms of what we're looking for, I'm always banging on about this idea of like a unique voice or an authentic voice. And I think that is not a great thing for me to say because it's hard to know how to get that. But my advice would be to be really specific in your work in terms of how your descriptions, your imagery. Don't just say, I mean, this is more like writing advice, but I think it helps with catching someone's attention, as if you've described a lake as a mirror. I've read that before, but what haven't I read? How would you, instead of it looking like a mirror, what does it really look like? And think of something that's really specific that maybe only you can think of, and I'm going to notice that. And I think Yeah, I think my last piece of advice, so we talked a little bit about how, and we'll probably get back to it, how important reading is for your practice. But my thing is actually revision. You know, it's easy to quickly, especially in these days when you submit via email. I was saying back in the olden days, we used to have to mail things away. So it's easy to fire something off, but just pause and take another look. Do one more revision. Get a friend to read it. There is no limit on how many revisions you can do, and it's just going to make the piece better. And that's going to give you your best chance of having it accepted. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we eventually did send Reo Pepe off to a publisher, we did go analogue, and we researched into which publishers would align with what we were doing and what their intentions for their publishing, you know, future publishing would be. And we identified three, and we wrapped up our Puka Puka in some paper blankets, and we got it in a parcel and we posted it to their office. Nice. And all three publishers came back and offered us different deals. So we took this approach of, yeah, grabbing their attention by putting something in the post, and I think book people do love that.
Mm-hmm. How nice is it to get mail these days? Yeah. And I guess we talked about before, you know, that when you're sending work, and this is kind of comes with the subject of rejection, actually. We've all been rejected, like, so many times, right? And we will continue to get rejected. How do we deal with that? And also, can we kind of talk about the behind the scenes, you know, why might an editor or a program director reject someone?
I mean, I deal with, like, double rejection because of being in acting and stuff as well. It's like, so maybe you could be like, oh, thank God I'm not an actor as well. Maybe that's one way to deal with it. But I don't know. I, like, I'm not going to say that.
Go on.
I was just going to say, like, I don't know. For me, I think this is probably, like, the ADHD, but I just move on to the next thing, and I kind of, like, mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, cool. But there have been times where those rejections have been really informative around what the work is. It can be a useful selection process for thinking about what a manuscript looks like, what's actually good, what's not, what has a context in this particular environment, what has a context in another environment. And that relates to the behind-the-scenes experience editorially as well, in that sometimes there will be an actor or a poem or something that's kind of interesting, and it's just not right for whatever that particular journal or outlet is looking for at that time. And understanding that genuinely has shifted my relationship to submission over time. For example, when I started publishing in the States, I was kind of aware of stuff going on in the New Zealand literary scene, and I was sending stuff off. And I was sending stuff to Landfall that was very, like, American experimental. It's just like, it's not Landfall. And then my practice started changing in relationship to the New Zealand scene. And then I started getting a few Landfall acceptances and things like that. So understanding that the feedback that you're getting is also about your positionality and the identity of the journal and the scene. And it's big. It's really big. It's really knotty, and it's really complicated. And it's mm-hmm. about how the pieces fit together. Is that clear?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, it's so easy to take it personally, right? But but actually, there's so many other factors at work. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I like even saying that logically. Sometimes I'm like, I want a nap. No more submissions.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and the persistence that you have to have to keep going, keep going. I mean, what do you think, Louise, in terms of rejection?
I think I, like, kind of sadistically enjoyed the process. But I think I was a bit like Josiah, where I'd send something off. And I think keeping record of what you've sent off and also, like, when you send it, yes, then, like, okay, what are you going to look at next? And so you're not just sending off one thing and sitting and waiting to hear back. So you're already doing something else, and that's a good distraction. And it means if you do get a rejection back, you're like, oh, well, I'm waiting to hear from these three other people. And mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how healthy it is in terms of like a workload and like, you know,
the mental health,
the drive forward, yeah, mental health and things. But I think that was very helpful for me. And I kind of saw it as like a job, which mm-hmm. helped remove that personal vulnerability. And I probably didn't learn till later the fact that, yeah, it's not just that they're rejecting like your work as such. There may be any number of things. Say, for example, with Starling, we're putting together an issue. So we might have some that we've already accepted. The last few pieces might be a bit more about what are we missing from the issue. Mm-hmm. So if we've already got four short stories, maybe we're not looking for another short story. So that might be the reason mm-hmm. that piece is rejected.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more at play than just mm-hmm. The work. Mm-hmm. But I do think, I probably did also submit things that weren't ready and I could have worked more on them myself. Mm-hmm. So there's that as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you want to add to that, Kitty?
I guess just from my perspective as a program director for the festival, like, sorry to say, but it is quite persona-based and there's so much work out there. There's so much amazing literature coming, like just getting shoveled to us from publishers, that it's actually when we get submissions from individuals, they're sort of like, unless there's something that's being offered that adds to a stage presence to put on a festival program, then it doesn't really get looked at, mm-hmm. to be brutally honest. And the work could be amazing, but it's the pile's too high. So, yeah, if there is some great persona that you can add.
For its worth, I do know my persona works. Like, every time I do, like, a persona on stage, I sell a bunch of books, and sometimes people read a poem and they're like, what is this? You know? So,
yeah, so that's some good advice. Get a persona and use it.
Sometimes it helps generate the work. Sometimes it's mm-hmm. not always healthy, but sometimes it's really powerful to be like, right now, the speaker of my poems are operating in this way, in this voice, and that's what I'm interested in. And these particular publishers and outlets seem to be interested in it, and I'm going to keep on targeting achieving this particular thing. So mm-hmm. it can be flipped as a positive as well as being like, ah, no, the persona. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What ifs? What ifs?
I think there's some practical things as well in terms of, like, I don't know about you guys, we talked about spreadsheets.
Yeah.
Spreadsheets are kind of gross, but they're also very handy. So make a spreadsheet where you're like, I've sent it to these people, I sent it on this date, I got the reply, it's a rejection. And the poems, the pieces that you send, because as editor, if I get the same poem again and that I've said no to, I'm like, hello. I've read that. I do remember it. I remember it, you know. Also, if you get a rejection from an editor who actually says not just a blanket response but says, please do try again, that's massive. Mm. Like they're going out of their way to say something different. And even though it's not, you're not quite there, that you're almost there. And you should try again, not with the same poems, with some different poems or a different work, essentially. Mm. Any other kind of practical tips before we open it up to the audience? No pressure.
I think just being mindful, like when you're saying keep the spreadsheet, another good thing to put in the spreadsheet is like they'll generally say on their website like when you can expect to hear back. So maybe not sending an email like the day after that day as much as you want to. Mm-hmm. I mean, this thing, especially in New Zealand, a lot of the people, like when we were saying like institutions, yeah, it's like me and Francis like running Starling outside of our day jobs and families and things. So yeah, like even though you want an instant reply, it's not, just hold off a little.
I think that's a key thing, right? Patience.
Yeah, patience.
Patience and persistence. The two P's you should remember. Publishing, patience, persistence.
Maybe like gracefulness as well. I haven't experienced this, but I've definitely heard some horror stories of people receiving rejections and then like lashing out at the journal. I mean, that should be self-explanatory. That's just like be a nice person, eh?
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe it does need saying. Like,
yeah.
That, and that sometimes the most, like, I don't know, like, oh, thanks. Thanks for reading that, you know? That's cool.
Yeah, and it does get noted, right? If you get a nice reply, like, thanks anyway. Yeah. You know, it's, it actually goes, it's just like, you know, the people being polite and conscientious, I think. And it's easy to kind of be the keyboard warrior, right? Like, because you're angry. I get angry when I get a rejection. Like, they don't get it. They don't understand.
We had a really hard situation with NPP where we've had a writer submit the same collection twice because the first time they submitted we were like, we'd like to look at it again next year, and it being really high quality and really close, and we had to say no twice because of the shuffle and things like that. And that person has been so gracious and so nice. And I just, that, like, it's definitely noted, and I don't know, it's meaningful because that person is actually part of the community of publishing that we're doing. It just hasn't been the right time.
Yeah. And the community's big, eh? I mean, the community's small, but it's a big deal, you know? Like, you want to be in it for the right reasons. You're not going to be sending hate mail. please don't send me any hate mail. I won't reply.
Thinly veiled hate mail poll.
I'm assuming, yes, Kate, I'm assuming we've got an hour, right? Is it? Yeah. Okay, so we've got some time, not much time. I'm sorry, I haven't actually left too much time, but I'm sure there are questions in the audience yes, at the front here. So I'm just going to repeat it for the podcast. So the vanity-style publishers that you pay for or agent-style publishers that will take you in and hopefully pay you?
New Zealand examples.
Yeah, you guys got?
I don't actually know specifically which publishers ask you to pay. But, I mean, is that information available on their websites usually?
Normally. And if they, you should normally know in advance. And if you're ever submitting somewhere and they like are suddenly asking you to pay, big red flag, definitely step away. The ones that you're aware of in general will be close to agent style due to being independent or affiliated with an institution. So that's like all of the university presses, a lot of the kind of like Dead Bird are really lovely and great, Compound are in Auckland as well.
Tender Press is a good one. These are all friendly presses, and you don't pay
for them. I reckon that's a really good point. If someone's asking you for money, it's a bit of a
red flag.
I mean, you do have to pay to enter things like competitions, and sometimes you have to pay to enter into a journal during a reading period, for example. But if a publisher's saying, okay, we've got your manuscript, here's the credit card thing, red flag. Yeah, so I guess it would be about just finding out on each website as to, and those things will come out in the wash, I think, as you start corresponding with those publishers.
I'd definitely, if you're thinking about kind of having a manuscript, I would be thinking about who you read on your shelf first, and kind of like look at those spines and then go, oh, these places.
Yeah.
In general, the ones that are asking you to pay are probably not publishers that you're likely to know too much about. And I'm a bit hesitant to name them because of relational stuff.
But, you guys could have a talk afterwards.
Yeah. On the radio.
Jackson, I think.
Two questions for our journal editors. Is it appropriate to reply to a rejection or acceptance letter? Does it help or does it just take up your time? And also about deadlines, would you advise to wait until close to the deadline or is it better to submit earlier?
For Landfall's submission, it doesn't. You don't have to reply, and in fact, it doesn't come to me. It goes to the administrators anyway. Sometimes they'll forward on correspondence if it is directed to me, not the hate mail, actually. I think they filter that stuff out. But sometimes they'll get a reply, but it's not certainly not compulsory. But if you get an email from me directly and I say, hey, I really liked it, or hey, can we talk about this line break or something, then of course. The reading period, no, the pool is open, you know, and so it doesn't matter what date it comes in, as long as it comes in before the deadline. It gets read, they all get read together. Is it the same for Starling?
Yeah, same. we're not judging based on when you submit it. My only thing with that is, like, if you have more time to revise, why not? And in terms of replying to responses, I think that's more the flip side for me. Sometimes we get people who would like individual feedback on their work. We actually give individual feedback to anyone who's a high school student who gets rejected, or anyone who comes really close to making an in but doesn't, which is very unusual. Almost all journals will not do that. So I like to think we're being as generous as we can. And so it is hard when we get people asking for comments on their work, because we just, it's, you know, it's hard to have that time to do it. So in those instances, if you are looking for feedback on your work and you're trying to ask editors for it, I would actually recommend not doing that and instead asking a friend, going to some workshops, like looking for that kind of support from peers, because it's not that people don't want to give you that feedback in those roles, it's just that they are very time poor.
Yeah, and that goes for that correspondence as well. I think that, you know, if you do enter into correspondence, it pays not to give your life story. You know, like I've received cover letters before that are like 4 pages long. I'm like, it's some poems, you know, like I just, it's really cool. You've got this stuff going on, but I just don't have time. And you can't really say that without sounding like a total bitch. But just keep it professional, I think, is the message there. Over here, could you talk about seeking professional editors or your process of editing to get the manuscript ready for publication? Yeah.
I do a lot of self-editing, and that's just because of the path through which I took to get published. But every publisher that I've worked with has engaged in an editorial process with me. With NPP, that sort of depends on the book. So both years for us as editors, there have been 2 out of 3 books that we've worked with, and then one that's sort of just like ready to go. It just sort of depends on the work and what's needed. In general, in my experience, both as someone who's published prose and poetry and someone who's edited, poetry is kind of hard to edit because there's so much voice stuff and it's about asking questions, and then you sort of have to trust that the person has the, I don't know, the juice to kind of work out what the answer to that question is. Prose, I've had really, really helpful structural edits from publishers. I've never sought out independent editorial advice other than from like friends in the writing community. I'd be careful and hesitant to reach out to someone that is like senior or to a kind of in the writing community, because like sometimes people send me stuff and I'm like, I can't read your book right now. I can't. So really relying on those people that the peers has been helpful for me.
Yeah, I'd agree. Peers, your friends who are writers themselves, that's definitely what I did for quite a long time, just asking friends to look at individual poems. When I had what I thought was a manuscript together, getting a friend to look at that, awesome. I am now in a position where my peers have a lot going on. They have families and things, so I feel really bad to ask them for that time. And I am in the position to be able to pay a few hundred dollars to get someone to look at it. So if you are in that position, there are lots of New Zealand writers, just off the top of my head, people like Sarah Jane Barnett, Freya Daly Sadgrove, Ash Javeda Jane, they all do freelance assessments. So if you can find them on Instagram, they have websites. Look, if there's a senior writer that you admire, they may actually do that work. I think Issa Maidanapiri does some of that stuff. So if you did have a sequence or a collection or whatever, and you had some money that you thought, I'd really like to use that to get some feedback, I personally think it's great. If you can get it from friends, even better. But yeah, I do that myself because I want my manuscript to be the best it can be before I send it to a publisher. And like Josiah says, if you have a publisher, they will work with you on editing as well. But I just want it to be the best that it can. So that's what I would try to do before I send it, and then ideally it gets even better from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Across all of my work I've used, and not just at LPP, but longer form stuff as well, I've used contract freelance editors and assessors are amazing for giving feedback.
Yes, there's lots of writers in the community that usually need work. And actually it's really good, right, to be edited. Amazing. Is such a treat. Such a cool thing to be on the receiving end of. Have we got more time, Kate? Should we have another question or should we wrap up? One more.
Do you think that your socioeconomic situation affects how achievable it is to have a career in writing or the opportunities that you have access to?
As in, is it going to stop you from entering those spaces? It's a really good question, I think. What do you think?
Very complicated question, because the internalized narratives that we tell ourselves as well are really important around writing. I mean, for most people, writing is not going to suddenly make you a lot of money. That's worse.
I think that's the elephant in the room a little bit. Eh?
Yeah, we all work, right?
Yeah.
We have day jobs.
I've got so many thoughts about that, but I don't know if I can compress them into an appropriate answer right now. I'm happy to talk to you after.
Yeah, I think it's really good to talk about, actually.
A really clear example of like how that operates on like the day-to-day level is like I work freelance, and right now I literally don't have time to write because I'm working 7 days a week. And so the stuff that I was doing to get published until this point is literally not possible in the context of my life right now. Mm-hmm. And that element of the way that time relates to the ability to navigate a creative practice is really tricky to think about, particularly because that early career step, you're very unlikely to get paid during. And that's a really tricky question to navigate. Like, I was lucky enough to have access to that early career step while a teenager in high school living at home. And
do you know one thing we can do, though? And this is going to get really political, and then I'm going to finish the session. is vote for the right party.
Yes.
Yeah. The party that will support creative endeavours, Creative New Zealand. I always use this example of Ireland. Ireland has a living wage for writers. Yes. Yeah. And how many great writers come out of Ireland? Like, we could be that if we supported our young people to write a book, for example. So, yeah, let's finish it there. Please join me in thanking our friends.
Thank you so much to our amazing panel, to Lynn Lee. That was really interesting and enlightening in a beautiful way to finish New Zealand Young Writers Festival 2025. Because this is the last event in the festival, I'm going to close with a karakia. Tuia ki ruka, tuia ki raro, tuia ki waho, tuia ki roto, tuia ki te here tangata, karongo te pō, karongo te ao. Homie, huie, taikie. Thank you all so much for being here.
The New Zealand Young Writers Festival welcomes young writers aged 15 to 35 of all kinds to celebrate a diverse range of wordsmithing, including slam poetry, playwriting, songwriting, short fiction, novels, zines, screenwriting, poetry, journalism, blogging, critical content creation, podcasts, review writing, and more. It's Aotearoa's only literary festival focused solely on young writers, and it's held right here in Otipoti, Dunedin. This live recorded podcast series from the 2025 New Zealand Young Writers Fest is brought to you by Otago Access Radio and supported by Dunedin UNESCO City of Literature. Join us in celebrating Aotearoa's next generation of literary talent.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.